This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
To keep you in suspense.
I had a be everyday grind.
Night transmissions. Hi, as you may have figured out while Heart of Nocturne was playing, this is a program called Night Transmissions. I'm Gary Clinton, your host, and the only reason you're not listening to Nocturnal Transmissions with Gary Clinton is that I changed my mind. That was my original thought. I'd call this show Nocturnal Transmissions. But then I thought, maybe that's in poor taste. And besides, maybe it's bad form to introduce yourself with a pun, so Night Transmissions it is. Do you know that sound? I'll bet you do. That's a really famous sound in the annals of old-time radio. The creaking door opened up every episode of The Inner Sanctum, a radio program which ran from 1942 to 1952 or thereabouts. Then, when Iron Brown decided to try to resurrect old-time radio in the 70s with CBS's Mystery Theater, he used the creaking door sound effect again. When South Africa decided to do their own version of The Inner Sanctum, they just went ahead and called it The Creaking Door and featured that sound effect prominently in the opening. The Creaking Door is one of many old-time radio shows about not which much is known. We don't know who the producer was, who wrote the program, or who was featured in the cast. Not really even when it ran. There's general agreement among old-time radio aficionados that it was in the 50s, but there is some reason to think that it could have been as late as the 60s. Anyway, this week we have a story about a very reluctant blood donor named John Smith and his warning of, "Don't take my blood."
I have flown. I have sailed. Moved about this world of ours, and ever in search of the finest of its kind, we bring you the tops in spine chillers. The creaking. Manufacturers of State Express 3-5 Filter King cigarettes take pleasure in presenting The Creaking Door.
Taste of new smooth State Express 3-5s today. We promise you, it's the smoothest cigarette you can get. It's a blend that has been perfected after years of constant research by our master blenders. And the recent development of an entirely new process which gives you an even smoother 3-5 smoke. We promise you, it's the smoothest cigarette you can get. Move in world class. Get the taste of new, smooth State Express 3-5s today.
Sort of name. John Smith. What could be more ordinary than that? But he is the most unusual man, really. Take his blood group, for instance. His blood group is group AB. Very rare indeed, as the doctor is pointing out.
Only 2% of people belong to group AB, Mr. Smith.
I know my group is very rare.
And this young girl is dying. She must have a transfusion as soon as possible, otherwise she will die. There's absolutely no doubt about that.
But surely I'm not the only person with this type of blood in the area?
No doubt there are other people, but we don't know everyone's blood group offhand, just like that. We depend, as you know, on blood donors. You're the only registered donor in this area.
But there must be someone else.
Believe me, Mr. Smith, there isn't. Anyway, giving a transfusion isn't anything to worry about. There's nothing to it.
I've given blood before. I know that.
Then you'll help us? You'll help the young girl?
I can't. I can't go through that again. I won't. You've no right to ask me.
Please, Mr. Smith, calm down. What I'm asking isn't that terrible.
Yes, it is.
But you said
you don't know what you're asking. I can't do it.
Mr. Smith, unless young Beryl Rogers receives a transfusion of blood, type AB blood, she will most certainly die.
There must be somebody else who can do it. Why pick on me?
I've told you why, Mr. Smith. You're the only registered donor in the area.
Well, then what about outside the area? What about blood banks? You keep supplies of blood under refrigeration these days, don't you?
Our own local supplies of AB blood from the blood bank are exhausted. To find supplies elsewhere and fly them here would take too long. The girl would die. Oh, hang it all, man. All I'm asking you to do is give a pint of your blood. That's all. Not your life.
No. That's not what you're asking. And you don't know what you're asking. I can't do it. I can't.
Very well. And then there's nothing more I can do. Well, I can't force you, I'm afraid. There is, unfortunately, no law which says that one must give blood. But I hope, Mr. Smith, that you'll be able to live with your conscience after tonight. After this young girl dies because you won't help. Then I hope you can face yourself in the mirror each day.
It wouldn't be saving her. Don't you understand? It wouldn't. It would be only postponing something which might as well be ended now. This girl's life has already ended. Unless you can find someone else to help.
You're the only one, Mr. Smith. I've told you before. You're the only one, her only chance.
Then if I'm her only chance, she hasn't got one.
You refuse to help her?
Yes.
Mr. Smith, this is a free country. You have every right to say that. You must have a very good reason for letting a young girl go to an untimely death like this.
I have.
Won't you tell me what it is?
You wouldn't believe me. Nobody believes me.
I promise. I listen with an open mind. You see, the girl's father is waiting outside to hear your decision. I'll have to tell him something.
All right. I'll tell you. I'll tell you what's been making my life a nightmare for the last 3 years. I first registered as a blood donor about 3.5 years ago. As you said, my group is the rarest. There aren't many donors. But also, there aren't so many people needing transfusions. So it was about 5 months before I was called on to help. He was a young man. Derek Evans. I still remember his name. He'd been badly cut up in a motor accident. They phoned me from this hospital at about 2 a.m. I came along here and gave 2 pints of blood. It saved young Derek's life. At least that's what we all thought. But it didn't save his life, really. It only saved him for a far more horrible death. 2 or 3 days after I'd given the blood, I came along to the hospital to see how he was getting on. By this time, he was sitting up in bed, looking quite well again. I was interested to see the man whose life had been saved by my blood, I suppose. But also, I felt I had to see him. You see, Doctor, my blood was flowing in his veins. Already I felt a strange sort of kinship with him. I sat on the chair beside his bed. I smiled at him. Oh, how are you feeling?
Fine. It's funny to think about it, isn't it?
What?
Well, that your blood is now flowing around my body, through my brain, and making me think and breathe.
Yes, it is.
Although I must confess, I don't feel any different.
Come on, darling. Jill, come on. This part's quite solid, and now she's well over to the west. Wait. Help! I'm sinking. No, don't come any nearer. Throw me a rope. Help! Jill, help! I'm in the quicksand. I'm sinking! Help!
Mr. Smith, are you all right?
What? Oh, good heavens. How terrible.
Oh, what is it? What's the matter? You've gone quite pale.
No, it's nothing. I'll be all right. But there was something. And I didn't dare tell him. As he'd been speaking, suddenly into my mind's eye, there flashed a picture that had been frighteningly real. It wasn't as if I had imagined myself somewhere else or anything like that. I'd been completely aware that I was sitting in the hospital ward. But in the front of my consciousness, it flashed a picture of young Derek Evans and a girl walking beside him. He'd suddenly stepped into a quicksand, and as I watched, horrified, I'd seen him sucked down into the morass. I didn't tell him what I'd imagined. It's not the sort of thing you'd tell a convalescent patient. But as soon as I could, I made my excuses and left. I tried to put the remembrance of it from my mind, but that night I couldn't sleep. The next morning, I made a phone call to Derek's parents.
Hello?
Mrs. Evans?
Speaking. Who's this?
My name isn't important. I wonder if you can tell me, has your son Derek got a girlfriend?
My son's engaged to be married. Who is he?
Please, this is very important. Could you tell me what his fiancée's name is?
Oh, really,
Please, it's very important.
Well, I don't know what business it can possibly be of yours, but her name is Jill.
I'd somehow known somewhere in the dark recesses of my mind that that was the name she was going to say. Jill. The name which I'd heard Derek call out in my vision. I was stunned. For a long time, I walked about like a man in a daze. Was it possible that the fact that my blood was flowing in his veins had somehow given me the ability to see into Derek's future? It seemed too unbelievable to contemplate. Finally, I decided to return to the hospital and tell him the whole story. It might well be nothing but nonsense,
But at least he should be warned, I thought. I phoned to check when I'd be allowed to see him.
What name was that again?
Evans. Derek Evans. He was in a motor accident.
Oh, that, Mr. Evans. I'm afraid it will be no use coming to see him, sir.
Why not?
He was discharged from hospital 2 days ago.
I phoned his home, of course. But his mother told me that he'd gone away for a week or so into the country to convalesce. She must have been a little suspicious of me making odd phone calls by this time, because she refused to tell me if I could get in touch with him. But looking back, it wouldn't have been any good anywhere. At the time, I told myself that I was behaving hysterically over nothing and tried to put the whole thing from my mind. I succeeded, too, up to a point, until a couple of days later. I bought the evening paper as usual. And there it was, staring me in the face. A young man, Derek Evans, was drowned today in a quicksand, not far from the village of Medside. His fiancée, Jill Worthing, was with him. Escaped unharmed. So now you see, Doctor, why I'm not going to give this young girl any of my blood. My blood is evil. It brings about death in the most horrible fashion. And worse than that, I know about it in advance.
News in world class. Get the taste of new smooth State Express 3-5s today. We promise you, it's the smoothest cigarette you can get. It's a blend that has been perfected after years of constant research by our master blenders. And the recent development of an entirely new process which gives you an even smoother 3-5 smoke. We promise you, it's the smoothest cigarette you can get. Move in world class. Get the taste of new, smooth State Express 3-5s today.
Why can't you leave me alone? You don't seem to understand what you're asking. I told you it's happened 4 times in the past, and each time I've lived under a terrible shadow of doom until the person concerned has died.
But look, if you believe what you say to be true, then one can take precautions. Take Derek Evans, for instance. He could have been prevented from going away into the country. The tragedy could have been avoided.
I said that with Rose Warwick. But at least in her case, I was sure that my vision couldn't possibly come true.
What happened?
Rose was a cripple. I gave her blood, saved her life. Then I saw her quite clearly in my mind's eye. She was screaming for help, and there was ice all around her and ice skating. The more I thought about it, the more impossible it was. She couldn't even walk, let alone skate. At last, I thought this sequence was going to be broken. I should be free.
And what happened?
She was in a crowded cinema when it caught fire. She died, burnt to death. And the film that was showing was called Winter Wonderland. All about ice skating.
Well?
Well, what?
Are you going to save my daughter's life, or are you going to let her die?
I can't do it, Mr. Rogers. Maybe your daughter, Bella, will live without my assistance.
That's quite impossible. And we only have about 15 minutes left at the outside.
I can't do it.
You're a monster, that's what you are. A monster. Now listen to me, Mr. Smith. I promise you one thing. If you don't help my little girl and she dies, I'll kill you.
All right. All right, what's the use? You don't want to understand either of you. I'll do it.
Good.
But I'm warning you. I won't be saving your daughter's life, Mr. Rogers. I'll just be keeping her alive so that she can die in a much more horrible fashion.
How's her respiration?
Normal, Doctor.
Send the donor?
I'm fine. Don't worry about me.
She's already getting some color in her cheeks. All right, nurse, remove the needle.
Very well, Doctor.
Mr. Smith, I can't thank you enough. Enough.
Don't leave me alone. Don't. I didn't mean...
Mr. Smith, what is it?
It's never happened as quickly as this before.
What's the matter?
As the nurse was removing the needle from her arm, I saw it.
What did you see?
The man was standing with his back to me. I couldn't see his face, but hers. It was terrible.
Poor girl. What? What did you see?
This man had his hands round her throat. He was strangling her. I haven't saved this poor girl, Doctor. She's going to be murdered. Well, how are you feeling?
I'm fine. Who are you?
Oh, I helped you when you were very sick.
Oh, you're the man who gave me some blood, aren't you?
That's right.
It's funny to think about it, isn't it? Your blood being pumped about inside me. It must be nice blood because I'm feeling much better.
I'm glad. How old are you, Belle?
16, nearly 17.
When are you leaving hospital?
About a week, the doctor said.
You will be careful, won't you? You're such a pretty girl.
Careful? What do you mean?
Nothing. Nothing, just be careful. I pray that it doesn't come true this time.
While I was in hospital.
Oh, nonsense, it's just...
You told me that if ever I was in trouble, if ever I needed any help...
Of course, there's nothing wrong, is there?
Well, you met my father, didn't you?
Yes, yes, I did. How is he?
He's dead. He died last month.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I don't know what to do. That's why I came to you. You see, I'm not quite 17 yet. Unless I have a respectable place to stay... Well, they're going to put me in a home.
That would be awful.
That's why I came to you. You said if ever I got a job, I could pay for my keep. It wouldn't cost you anything. I haven't got any relative or friends. My mother's been dead for years. I've tried to work out what I should do. And you're the only person I could think of. Please, won't you help me?
No, don't cry. Of course I'll help you.
I've been thinking about you quite a lot these last 3 or 4 months. Keep an eye on you. Maybe this time I can make sure that that vision didn't come true. She moved in. I had a big house and there was plenty of room. I've never married, never had a family. And it was wonderful at first. Just having someone to care about and someone who cared about me. Oh, there was nothing else in it but that. I know what people have been saying, but that was nonsense. She was like a daughter to me, the daughter I'd never had. And then she brought my help. From the start, I didn't trust him. He was too cocky, too confident. And he was evil.
Uncle John, this is Mike.
Oh, pleased to meet you, I'm sure.
How do you do?
We're going out for a drive.
Yes, of course. Well, don't be too late back, will you?
Oh, don't worry, Mr. Smith. I'll bring her back safe and sound.
Inside said that if I allowed her to leave, this Mike was going to strangle her. It had always been true before. I had to make sure it didn't come true this time. I had to. I raced up the stairs after her and threw open the door of her room. She had an open suitcase on the bed and was throwing clothes into it.
Now, leave me alone.
You're not leaving.
Yes, I am. And you can't stop me.
I can't I? I'll see you do as I tell you, you little tramp. I'll see that you don't get murdered. I'll save you in spite of yourself.
Please leave me alone. Stop. Stop choking me. Take your hand, please. You murderer.
Just as I'd seen. And now I knew why the figure whose back I'd seen been vaguely familiar. It had been me who I'd seen commit murder.
All right, Sergeant. Take him away. I only hope the judge believes your story, Smith. Because I don't.
He has a few blood brothers, in fact.
After years of constant research by our master blenders, and the recent development of an entirely new process which gives you an even smoother 3-5 smoke. We promise you, it's the smoothest cigarette you can get. Move in world class. Get the taste of new, smooth State Express 3-5s today.
This is your host back again. Just a reminder of our rendezvous next week. Where are we going? Through the creaking door, of course.
The manufacturers of State Express 3-5 Filter King cigarettes invite you to listen next Saturday at 9 o'clock when they will again present The Creaking.
Next up is an episode of one of my favorite shows, period. It's the British import, The Price of Fear. This week, the host of the show, Vincent Price, invites us to come as we are. Well, the invitation is only for one, and we are a bit late. After all, it was issued for April the 6th of 1974. But I think it'll be okay if we all just show up anyway. What do you say? Let's go.
The Price of Fear, brought to you by Vincent Price. I'd like to call this little story Come As You Are. You know, that meaningless concession that gets added onto invitations to parties. It's because the seemingly endless business of dressing up is such an integral part of my professional life that among my friends, my very positive reluctance to attend any kind of fancy dress party or costume ball is not only well established, but understandingly accepted. On a recent trip to London, I was genuinely delighted to find my old friend Charles Vane's invitation awaiting my arrival. It wasn't until I'd reached that key and to me ominous phrase, "fancy dress will be worn," that my heart sank. The fact that my would-be host had crossed it through and substituted "come as you are" afforded little by way of consolation. There can be few experiences so desultory as to find oneself sober-suited in the midst of a determined company of, let's pretend, Casanovas, paunchy Tarzans, moth-eaten King Kongs, with just the odd high chief executioner thrown in for good measure. As I put Charles's invitation back in its envelope, I'd already instinctively decided to decline, but it wasn't without a strong feeling of regret. Although in recent years our meetings had been few and far between, I still count Charles as one of my closest friends. We'd first met in the 30s when I came to London as a drama student, and since then had followed each other's ups and downs with particular interest. In Charles's case, of course, the ups, not to mention the downs, would have been difficult to ignore. Apart from being one of the youngest self-made tycoons ever, his social activities could scarcely be described as mundane. The sheer showbiz style of his personal life, his three marriages, and the inevitable million-dollar settlements had made Charles the darling of every gossip columnist from New York to Singapore. But apart from his sagacity and charm, Charles Vane was also noted for his ruthless determination in the face of all obstacles. Even as I mailed my politely phrased refusal of his kind invitation, I had the distinct feeling I was not to be let off the hook so lightly. The 2 a.m. phone call confirmed my misgivings.
Oh. Hello.
Vincent, it's damn well not good enough, do you hear?
What? Oh, I'm sorry. Who is that?
It's not only not good enough, I'm damn well not going to take no for an answer.
Charles. Oh, Charles, is that you?
It's on account of that damn stupid fancy dress bit, isn't it? So why do you think I changed it to come as you are in the first place?
Out of the question. The intimacies of my sleeping attire must remain a closely guarded secret.
Don't be skittish. In a way, all I hope is you have sufficient sense to keep the damn thing.
The damn, what, the invitation?
Yes, of course the invitation is what you're keeping me from my beauty sleep about.
I'm keeping you?
Yes, well, on the back you'll find a simple set of directions for getting here. A child of five could manage it. I've marked the priory with a damn big cross in the top right-hand corner.
The priory?
The house, my house. You will love it.
Oh, yes, I'm sure I would, Charles. But as a matter of fact, I have another appointment.
I shall expect you at 8.
But, Charles, I honestly don't see how
will
I
you
can...
let me get some sleep, damn you?
Charles, are you there? Charles? Charles? Oh, lots. Put to the test, Charles's simple set of directions might well have been comprehensible to a 5-year-old child, but not having one of them with me in the passenger seat, I spent hours exploring the same piece of countryside in ever-decreasing circles. I was just on the point of returning to London when I spotted the entrance to his drive, and within minutes I was standing in the hall of one of the most remarkably beautiful houses it has ever been my pleasure to enter. The party was obviously in full swing.
Oh, there you are. Let the festivities commence. Vincent, you're late, damn it.
Oh, Charles, how good to see you.
I've been ringing that ridiculous hotel of yours for the best part of the evening.
What?
I thought you'd gone and funked out at the last minute.
Oh, I am sorry about that. Your directions weren't as explicit as you cracked them up to be.
Huh?
As a matter of fact, as a cartographer, your talent seemed to be singularly lacking.
Nonsense. Anyway, seeing as how you finally made it, come along into the library.
All right.
We'll fortify ourselves with a brandy or three before I introduce you to the somewhat dubious delights of the snake pit.
All right.
There you go, then.
Bye. Oh, I am sorry. Thank you.
Hey, you're miles away.
Yes, I'm just taking it all in.
Nice. Yeah, impressive, isn't it?
Beautiful, Charles.
Puts me a pretty packet, I can tell you.
Really beautiful.
Point taken. Yeah, you're quite right, of course. The heathen financier in me. Always been under the impression they amounted to much the same thing. Anyway, here's to it.
And to your health and to your house. Tell me about it.
Surprise? Well, don't expect me to go into the full historic bit. But for all that, mentioned in the Domesday, one of the gems of early English monastic architecture, you know the kind of thing.
Well, I'm more than prepared to believe it.
Yeah, the domestic conversions came later, but it's still pretty exceptional. Anyway, I first fell in love with the place about 5 years back when I was a guest here at a party.
Oh?
A rather bizarre junket given by the wife of the then owner.
Oh, I see.
Well, I think she realized I rather coveted the place from the word go. And last season, we met up again in the south of France. She told me her lifestyle had changed somewhat since our last meeting, and judging by the bevy of young Apollos she had in tow, I was more than prepared to believe it. Well, I eventually got round to the house, and she said that providing the figure was right, the place was mine for the asking.
Well, it obviously was, then.
Let's just say the contract was concluded to the mutual satisfaction of both parties, shall we?
You're the same old Charles.
So, here we are. 9 months later, and it's housewarming night on the old corral. Right, let's be having you then. My lord, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the snake pit.
My original misgivings about accepting Charles's invitation proved well justified. Charles's come-as-you-are concession proved a somewhat dubious advantage. My conventional business suit seemed to generate the same degree of cool hostility as if I'd elected to wear it at a convention of nudists. It was with a very positive feeling of relief that I eventually escaped the throng and sought out some corner strategically removed from the general merrymaking. The minstrel's gallery seemed perfect. Suitably fortified with a private bottle of Charles's excellent Dom Cliquot, I climbed to my remote perch as eagerly as any canary in its gilded cage, a positive refuge where I could ponder the idiot antics of my fellow man and consider myself well out of it.
And so you are, old fellow, so you are. Well out of it.
In the gloom of the gallery, I'd almost stumbled over the man. I managed a rather startled apology, but even when my eyes had grown accustomed to the darkness, the details of his physical appearance remained extremely vague. The quality of his voice, the spare, angular outline of the silhouette he presented, suggested someone of middle age, but then he could just as well have been a great deal older. Only for the briefest of instants was I positively aware of his pale, watery eyes, opaque behind the glint of his old-fashioned pince-nez.
I hope I didn't startle you.
Somewhat, I must confess. I didn't realize I was intruding.
A temporary refuge from the madding crowd, eh?
Yes, I know it must seem ungracious.
Oh, to some it might. For my own part, well, given the option, I'd have been abed and asleep hours ago. Oh, why don't you take a seat?
Oh, thank you so much. Allow me to introduce...
On these occasions, formal introductions always strike me as superfluous. On top of which, I can't offer my hand.
Oh?
A somewhat unfortunate accident.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. If I were to fetch another glass...
Oh, it doesn't agree with me. But why don't you?
Oh, thank you.
I'm glad to observe that one of us at least had the courage to refuse being bullied into dressing the part.
Fancy dress. As in some ways it might have been easier to oblige.
The proverbial sore thumb, eh?
Yeah.
In my own case, well, there was little option.
Oh?
My wife, you know. She positively revels in this kind of revel. But possibly you've already observed her. Titania in all her glory.
Oh, yes. As a matter of fact, I have.
It would be difficult not to.
Well, extremely effective.
Ridiculously pathetic.
What?
I can think of few sights so ludicrously tragic as a middle-aged siren aping the appearance and manners of a young girl half her age. Do I embarrass you?
Well, I...
Oh, you must forgive me, but her penchant for youth is so notorious. I now feel little reluctance to talk about it. Her companion this evening, for instance.
Oh, you mean the young man in the costume
you
of
have
Harlequin?
To. Yeah. Though the appurtenances of a gigolo might have been more appropriate.
Oh?
Her darling boy of the moment. Luigi del Potrello. The name means nothing to you?
Del Potrello. Oh, yes, it does sound familiar.
In most circles, it has a certain notoriety. Ah. The Potrellos are Italian merchants.
Oh, yes.
Extremely wealthy, hideously flamboyant, and totally without any distinction, taste, or breeding. Right from the outset, my home seemed in a perpetual state of siege. Filet doux by every post, secret assignations, ridiculously extravagant floral arrangements. And then the ultimate indignity of having the scoundrel pay court under my very roof. To be made constantly aware of their asinine sniggerings, their barely concealed whisperings, their grotesque fondlings, the middle-aged lovebird and her twittering young chick. But it wasn't until he started implanting his obscene influence on the house itself that my anger and frustration reached full spate.
How obscene?
Yes, it's obscene. Isn't it extraordinary how something as seemingly insignificant as a mirror can underline the absolute pathos of one's situation, underline it with far greater emphasis than any of the indignities and infidelities that have gone before.
Well, I'm not sure that I understand. You did say a mirror?
Yes, one of his many gifts to her. A hideously ornate creation in the fashionable Florentine manner. You know the kind of thing. All gilt cupids, intricately entwined vine leaves.
Yes, I'm afraid I do.
Exactly, my dear fellow. Needless to say, quite out of keeping with the sober antiquity of my own furnishings. But a token of regard from her own darling boy, don't you see? And as such, to be blatantly hung in a place of honor. It seemed suddenly as if he were trying to destroy the very fabric of our lives.
Would it be impertinent of me to inquire?
What happened?
Yes.
No, but why not? It's probably common knowledge. The inevitable scene is the phrase that most readily springs to mind. But somehow, more significant than anything that had gone before.
Oh, you're exaggerating as usual.
I honestly don't think you realize
the gravity of the situation. Oh, my God, I wish Luigi were here to...
For God's sake, can't we leave the fellow out of it for once?
Easier said than done, my pet.
What's that supposed to mean?
Whatever you care to make of it.
I cannot...
Oh, careful now, darling. If you were to invite comparisons, you might come out of it rather badly.
Might I?
But that's probably what's behind this ridiculous outburst, isn't it? The darling boy really has excelled himself this time, hasn't he? Such an appropriate gift. A direct invitation to see yourself as you really are.
So why the hell don't you tell your darling boy he can take his bloody mirror right back where it came from?
We'll have to see, won't we, my dear?
And was the mirror taken back?
I presumed it must have been. I certainly don't recall seeing the damn thing again. But then, quite suddenly, that's to say, we both had more important things on our minds.
Oh?
I'd spent the day at the British Museum doing some research. I got home to find my wife had been taken seriously ill. In effect, a minor heart attack.
Oh.
I could only conclude it was a direct result of trying to keep up with her dissolute gadfly. The doctor advised that complete rest was absolutely essential. He also emphasized that there must be no undue excitement or shock. Yes, he particularly stressed the last bit, or shock. Even as he said it, it sounded strangely significant.
Why significant?
Well, as it turned out, I'd stayed up reading very late one night. I must have dozed off. Because I was suddenly startled awake by a noise. It came from the head of the stairs.
What kind of a noise?
Difficult to describe, but a sort of bump, I suppose. A slight trip, perhaps. The servants had retired hours before. There was only my wife. At least, I believed that to be the case. Until... I heard their voices coming from my wife's bedroom. I recognized Luigi's laughter immediately. Then, after a while, there was only silence. I think that silence was the most difficult thing to bear of all. For the first time, I admitted to myself that I had lost my wife to Luigi forever.
And your reaction?
How can one describe? Resignation, love, jealousy, hate, yes. All at the same time. I wanted her dead.
What?
I needed her dead. But had no notion how I could achieve it. I'm not a courageous man, not even an artful man. I returned to the study. And there, I saw something that seemed to suggest the perfect solution.
Yes, go on.
Shortly before her illness, I'd drawn my wife's attention to a book dealing with the medieval history of the house.
Yes. Well,
needless to say, she discarded it halfway through. But there was one particular section that not only claimed her interest, but held it in a state of shocked disbelief I'd never witnessed before. It concerned a ghost.
A ghost?
Most historic homes seem to lay claim to one. Knowing my wife's somewhat nervous disposition, I'd previously kept ours something of a closely guarded secret. But now, no undue excitement or shock was what the doctor had said. There and then, I determined my ghostly inhabitant should serve his turn.
Well, what kind of a ghost?
The ghost of a Franciscan friar. The costume wasn't too difficult to improvise. A burnous, one of those Arab nightdress affairs, complete with hood, served my purpose to perfection. I put it on, lit a candle, left my study. I crossed the hall. The stairs creaked as I began to climb. I didn't mind. It only added to the theatricality of the scene I was about to enact. I could already imagine slowly opening the door of my wife's bedroom, hear her call out, "Who's there?" See the expression on her face as she watched in terror the specter of the Franciscan friar loom towards her. Perhaps one brief, terrified scream. And then, I just reached the top of the stairs, was about to cross the landing, when I saw it, the actual specter there, confronting me. The face shrouded in its hood, the candle flickering in its hand, the eyes deeply socketed, stared accusingly into mine. For a long moment, there was only disbelief at what I saw. And then, panic. I tried to move, but couldn't. I tried to scream out. No voice came. Then, with a newfound volition of its own, my arm lashed out at the heavy brass candlestick I was holding, lashed out at the ghastliness of that grizzled face. God help me. In the name of Christ, somebody help me.
For God's sake, man.
Oh, my God, Charles. Charles.
What the devil do you mean by slinking off like that?
I'm sorry.
Well?
I turned towards my distraught storyteller, but he was gone, probably realizing he was in imminent danger of being forced back into the swinging multitude below.
Oh, come along, man. Don't just hang around in the gloom. There's somebody special I want you to meet.
From the far end of the library, Titania herself confronted me. She sat there enthroned in one of Charles's splendid high-backed chairs.
Captain of our fairy band, mortal darlings, close at hand.
She misquoted from the bard. Titania made very short work of a very large brandy. In view of my so recent conversation with her husband, I must have looked somewhat taken aback. She was not slow to notice the fact.
Something worrying you, darling.
Well, it's pure coincidence, of course, but I've had the pleasure of making your husband's acquaintance.
My husband?
Yes.
You did say my husband?
Yes.
Oh, damn you, Charles. You haven't gone and told every Tom, Dick, and Harry my little secret. You know I particularly asked you to keep it strictly entre nous. Luigi would be furious.
Luigi? But that isn't your husband.
Oh, what a damn fool I am. Now I've gone and let the cat out of the bag. You must have been referring to that dreadful old dodder I was imbecile enough to spend the best years of my life with.
Now, darling, we mustn't speak ill of the dead.
The dead?
Thank God. The best part is 2 years, isn't it, Charles? Even at the very end, the old dodder proved as parsimonious and mean-minded as he'd been all along. Still, he paid for it. One of the few comforting things in life is that one can always depend on getting exactly what one deserves.
Or deserving exactly what one gets.
Oh, Charles, darling, you are being cynical. Anyway, I must away. Luigi's gone missing, don't you know? It isn't that I don't trust the darling boy, darling. It's simply that I don't. Goodbye, Mr.
Goodbye.
Charles, darling. Oh, it's been bliss. But Titania, darling, must away to live and fight another day.
What the hell was all that about?
Charles, tell me about him, her late husband.
Edward.
Was that his name?
Well, I only met the old stick once, and then very briefly, on my first visit to the place.
This place?
Well, of course. This was his house. He died here.
Where? Where exactly did he die?
You know, you look really peaky.
Answer the question, for God's sake. Please, Charles.
Well, as a matter of fact, at the head of the stairs.
The stairs leading to the minstrel's gallery?
Yes.
And the circumstances...
Oh, a bit unusual, really. It was Helen who found him. Apparently the old fool was on his way to bed, all got up in this ridiculous dressing gown thing of his when he spots this mirror.
The mirror? At the head of the stairs? It was Luigi's mirror, wasn't it?
Oh, has darling boy been telling you all about that?
Wasn't it?
Yes, a gift to Helen. The old boy raised such a stink about it, she locked it away at the back of a cupboard. Anyway, one night after a somewhat torrid meeting with her darling boy... Luigi raises Cain and insists on hanging it out in the open.
Directly at the top of the stairs. So that anyone coming up them would be bound to see his own reflection, wouldn't he?
Which is exactly what happened. Edward spots it, loses his temper, and smashes the thing to smithereens. Yeah, it was that caused the heart attack, of course. Not to mention his hand.
What about his hand?
Well, severed. Quite severed. Extraordinary violence that can be generated through a fit of jealousy, isn't it? I wish you'd have another brandy.
Will you tell me what he looked like, Charles?
Oh, Edward. Oh, do even better.
Charles handed me a snapshot. It was faded, but I spotted him immediately. One face among many, but I'd have recognized it anywhere. Not because of any particular feature... But because there, staring out at me, were the same pale, watery eyes, opaque behind the glint of his old-fashioned pince-nez. I handed the photograph back.
Oh, thanks. Well, might as well get rid of it.
Oh.
Not much point dwelling on the dead, is there?
No. Not much. Charles invited me to stay the night. I automatically refused. Some weeks later, he suggested we meet up again before he left on a business trip to the continent. The Priory was again suggested as a rendezvous. But in view of what had gone before, at the very last minute, I switched it to my hotel dining room instead. The decor hideously modern. The food bad, the waiters rude. The place positively bulging with people. I wouldn't have had it any other way.
was Vincent Price, bringing you The Price of Fear. Co-starring in Come As You Are was Maurice Perry, with Betty Huntley Wright and Peter Williams. Come As You Are was first recounted and dramatized by Bill Ingram and produced by John Dyer.
Segment today is an hour long, and it's comprised of the only two-part episode ever done by the radio show Escape. From February the 5th and the 12th of 1950, we have an adaptation of a novel by George R. Stewart, which is considered one of the classic and earliest post-apocalyptic tales. It's a wonderful book. I remember reading it first when I was, I must have been about 14, and then reading it again when I was about 15, and then again, even later. I haven't done that with very many books, read them again and again that way. This book is so good, you really ought to read the book. So I've posted a PDF copy of this book at the website. The website is www.nighttransmissions.com. Night Transmissions is one word. No space, no underscore, nothing between the night and the transmissions. Just one word. If you go there, you'll discover to the left side of your screen a navigation menu that's supposed to look like an old book. One of the selections on the navigation menu is called The Shows. If you click on The Shows, you'll be presented with a list of the shows done so far. Click on number 17. That's this show. Towards the bottom of that page, there's a section labeled Downloads. And in there, you'll find downloads that are related to this particular show. In this case, among other things, there's a PDF version of the entire novel, Earth Abides. There are a couple of other things there, too, also related to Earth Abides, that you might want to check out. Anyway, like I said, that's www.nighttransmissions.com. Okay, I'm going to shut up now. You know, I keep saying on these shows that I'm not going to run my mouth too much in these introductions. But I don't seem to be able to carry through on that promise, do I? Anyway, here it is.
You, finding life rather dull, dreaming again of exotic places, wishing you were somewhere else, we offer you Escape.
Today, Escape brings you one of the most unusual and terrifying stories of recent years. It is a story of such scope that the producers of Escape, in order to dramatize its full impact, will present it in two episodes. So now, with the performance of John Daner as Isherwood Williams, we bring you part one of George Stewart's powerful novel, Earth Abides. If a killing type of virus strain should suddenly arise by mutation, it could, because of the rapid transportation in which we indulge nowadays, be carried to the far corners of the earth and cause the death of millions of people.
If you should awake some morning, tomorrow morning, let's say, if you should wake to a man-dead world, where virtually all of human life had been dissolved from the face of the earth, leaving behind only buildings, bridges, machines, if you should awake to such a world tomorrow morning, what would you do? Where would you go? My name is Isherwood Williams. I was a student of ecology. I was in the Northern California wilderness gathering specimens of rock, plant, and animal life. I was alone, and had been for a month. Climbing up to a sharp ledge one day, I felt a sudden sharp pain in my extended right hand. I withdrew it under reflex and looked up, and there, a foot above my head, I saw him, a rattler, coiled, ready to strike again. Slowly, carefully, I lowered myself and began to suck the poison from the bite. I wrapped a handkerchief about my wrist, tourniquet style, and headed for my cabin. There, I broke open my snake bite outfit, cut a neat crisscross in my hand at the point of the wound, and applied the rubber suction pump. Then I lay down on my cot. I felt sick. Sick because of the poison. Sick because I was alone. I was weak. In a few moments, deep, warm blackness closed in about me. I don't know how long I was unconscious, but I was awakened by the door.
Harry? Harry, look here. This one's still alive, I think.
Hello. I'm glad you came. I'm sick.
He's still alive, all right. Don't go near him. Come on, let's get out of here.
Wait. I'm sick. Come back. Why? Why did they leave me when they knew I was sick? What were they afraid of? I tried to stand. My knees were like sponge rubber. But finally, I was able to stumble to my chest of drawers. And then I saw the hammer, my rock hammer, resting on the top of the chest. And it suddenly became the most important thing in the world to me. If I can lift this hammer, I told myself, I will live. I wrapped my fingers about its handle, and I lifted it slowly, then let it down. I breathed a sigh of relief. I would live. In the morning, I felt better. I got up, packed the car, and headed for the nearest town, Hudsonville, about 10 miles to the south. They'd take care of me in Hudsonville.
Consider, if you will, the case of the rest that once inhabited Christmas Island, a small bit of tropical verdure some 200 miles south of Java. In 1903, a new disease sprang up. The rats proved universally susceptible and soon were dying by the thousands. In spite of great numbers, in spite of an abundant supply of food, in spite of a rapid breeding rate, the species is now extinct.
Hudsonville. The familiar houses, stores, taverns, but no one on the streets. A hen scratched quietly in the dust. A lonely dog was howling somewhere. I got out of the car and walked into a little restaurant. The place was empty.
Hey. Is anybody here? Hey!
Silence.
deathly silence. On the counter, I saw a newspaper. Flipped it open. The headline,
Crisis. Acute.
I read the story, a dispatch from Washington.
The federal government is herewith suspended as of the emergency. All officers, including those of the armed forces, will put themselves under the orders of any functioning local authority by order of the acting president.
Front page, column 3.
The West Oakland Hospitalization Center has been abandoned. Its functions, including burials at sea, are now concentrated at the Berkeley Center. Keep tuned to your radio.
The radio! The radio in my car. I turned the dial to the most powerful station in the vicinity. Static. Nothing but static. Desperately, I twisted it from one end of the band to the other, praying for a human voice, a bar of music, anything. There wasn't a single radio station still in operation. The horn. Someone will hear the horn. Silence and death. I leaned back in the seat, exhausted. I sat that way for minutes before I looked at the paper again. The paper. The last sign of human life left to me. It was dated a week before. I read it through twice. Whole cities had perished. Medical centers, bodies. Doctors, nurses, burial crews hard at work, and then they too had fallen and died. The United States, the world, the stagnant flesh pool of death. Suddenly, with terror, I thought of home. I started for San Francisco. On the way, I helped myself to a tank full of gas at the station. Oddly enough, the pumps were still working. Electricity still flowed from the river-driven generators, and the lights still blazed. I wondered how I had survived. Perhaps the snake venom had counteracted the virus. Perhaps the clean wilderness, who could say? But somewhere, someone else was alive. The men at the cabin door, there must be others, but where? I passed some cows in a pasture. Smiled to myself at the irony. The world belonged once again to the animals.
Ecological observation. Pedigree means nothing now. The prize, which is life itself, will go to the keenest brain, the staunchest limb, the strongest jaw. The champion boars will die in their well-kept pens, but the Schultz will roam wild. In a few generations, their legs will grow slim, their bodies thin, their tusks longer. Man, they need nothing from man.
I passed 4 or 5 cars on the highway, abandoned. But farther along, I spotted another car, and there was a man inside. I stopped and got out. He had fallen over the wheel. There was a bottle beside him and a strong smell of cheap liquor. I shook him. Come on, come on. Come on, wake up. Wake up, wake up. Wake up, I said.
Hey,
come on,
listen,
now, come on.
Now, leave me alone. Now, you just leave me alone.
I said, wake up. What's your name? Your name.
Oh, what difference does it make?
Now, come on, come on. Don't go back to sleep. What's your name?
Barlow. Barlow's my name. 58 Barlows in the Seattle telephone directory, and I'm the only one left. Me, the dirtiest skunk of the lot. What am I doing alive? Answer me that.
Go back to sleep, Mr. Barlow.
Wait, 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 wait. Here, here. It's free on the house. Everything's on the house now. Have a drink.
Oh, thanks.
Let me tell you why I'm still alive. Because I'm being punished. I'm not good enough to die.
Oh, goodbye, Mr. Barlow.
Hey, come on back. I'll buy you a drink. It's good. I'll buy you a drink. Look here, I got $500. I took it from a bank yesterday. You want it? Here. $500.
San Francisco, the mute, dead city of San Francisco, a naked forest of concrete with its empty streets, its ghosts of newspapers blowing across alleys. I crossed the Bay Bridge, stretched over the blank water. A single car, coupe, parked in an emergency recess with its sole possessor now. The Bay Bridge, a final monument to the greatness that had been mankind. I drove the familiar route toward home. Turned right at San Lupo Drive, pulled up in front of the house. I walked up the stairs, took out my key, opened the door. Strange odor of must and stale food blew out at me. Mom? Dad? Mom! I fell into a chair and cried.
Observation. The desert and the wilderness began a long time ago. Men came only in the latter centuries. They camped at the springs and wore faint trails through the mesquite bushes. They laid rails, strung wire, paved long, straight roads. After a while, men were gone, leaving their small works behind them. In 1,000 years, at a conservative estimate, man will be a forgotten stone in the jungle.
Where would I go? I had no idea. I only knew I had to keep going. Change of place was my only comfort now, the only way I had of convincing myself that there was still life in the world. The snake bite began to hurt again, but it felt good, some small sign of living flesh. I left San Francisco and started across what had once been the United States, Route 66, through the giant Southwest, the towns, the empty, dead towns, the dust-blown, silent towns passed me by, one after another. Kingman, Flagstaff, Albuquerque, Oklahoma City. Just outside Guthrie, I saw a Negro tending his garden as if nothing had happened. He was afraid. He waved me on with a shotgun. In Tulsa, the sprinklers were still going in the park. I stopped. In Fayetteville, Arkansas, I heard music. Came from a little bar. Neon lit, spitting its bright invitation to the empty street. I took my hammer and went inside. The bottles were stacked neatly, bar rag over the rack, and a broken jukebox, blazing in blues and reds, singing its song to the vacant varnished tables.
And you just want to jump up and down like a carnival.
Shut up.
It's love.
Shut up.
There's a sparkle in me.
Shut up. Shut up. Shut up.
Shut up. But you're soaring to where? Oh, but it's love.
I slept in the best auto courts of the most luxurious hotels. I slept and ate from the leavings of 150 million people. All the wealth of America had been bequeathed to me. All its wealth and its death.
We
3 days later, I pulled up the Pulaski Skyway, crossed George Washington Bridge, came to Manhattan. The splendid, slow-decaying corpse of Fifth Avenue, the sable mink in the windows, the silly traffic lights changing color at naked intersections. Manhattan, soulless and dead.
Stretched out between its rivers, the city will remain for a long time. Stone and brick, concrete and asphalt, glass. Time deals gently with them. A window pane loosens, vibrates, breaks in a gusty wind. Lightning strikes, loosens the tiles of a cornice. The shade trees on the avenues die in their shallow pockets. Bats fly from the 59th floor. City dies slowly.
In the afternoon, I saw smoke from a chimney in the Bronx. I drove to the house, a small house, and knocked on the door. I heard footsteps. When the door opened, I saw a little bald man with a broad smile, holding a handful of playing cards.
Milt Carson, how do you do? Come on in. You're in time for supper.
Well, thanks. I just ate.
Mrs. Carson.
How are you?
Won't you sit down?
Thanks.
Where are you from?
California.
I had a relative there.
We're just finishing a hand of gin. Say, look here. Isn't that a beauty?
The television set, yes. Yeah, it's beautiful.
It's a combination radio, television set, radio player. I'll bet it even does the washing. It took us 2 days to get it up the steps from the radio store.
I always wanted a set like that.
Yes, but there's nothing on the air.
Sir, always wanted a set like that. Jen, there you are.
I owe you $10,000.
Give it to me tomorrow. There's a busted window at the Chase National. All the money you want. I carry $50,000 with me all the time just to be on the safe side.
Of course you can't buy anything with it now, but it sure feels nice to carry around.
How about some salami?
No, thanks. I just ate.
Oh, yeah. Say, do you like canasta?
Not much at cards.
Oh, canasta, I could teach you. It's simple, like rummy, but a little different. What I was wondering was, why don't you stay here? I got everything you'd want right here in the Bronx. Need a coat for the lady, break a window at I.J. Fox. You should see some of the diamonds I got Mrs. Carson at Tiffany's yesterday. Beauties. Hey, where are you going?
I've got to get started.
Well, where? There ain't no place to go.
Lots of luck.
Well, thanks, but I wish you could stay with us.
No, thanks. Goodbye. Oh, the scavengers. How long would they last? Through the winter? And it was doubtful. There'd be no central heating. Even breaking furniture in the fireplace wouldn't keep them alive. They were like highly bred spaniels or Pekingese who walked the city's streets at the end of their leashes. They would die with the city a season or two later, pneumonia, accident. The Negro in Oklahoma with his heart to the land, he would survive. Milt Carson and his new wife, no. They were waiting for death at the card table. Two weeks later, I was in San Francisco again. The streets were just as bare as when I left. The lights were still on, but dimmer now. Water flowed still from the faucets. But San Francisco had a new population, the dogs. They hunted in packs, all breeds bound together in the common search for food. Danes, Dalmatians, Scotties, toys, all of them. The dogs had taken over the city. And I decided to move back into the house because of the familiar things. Late one afternoon, I went out to look around the neighborhood, and I heard the yelping too late. As I looked around me, I saw myself being surrounded by dogs. They were hungry, ravenously hungry, and they started to close in. The car was on the street some 50 feet away. If I could make the car, the dog made a lunge for me. I kicked violently and started to run. They were after me, some of them running at my legs. He reached the car, opened the door, and slammed it. They climbed to the window, baring their fangs, their red tongues, wet with hunger. But I was safe. Then the night. And that night, the lights went out. The lights.
The lights. Hey, the lights. What happened to the lights? I looked out over the city. It was black. Black as death. The age of electricity was over. Finished. And there were candles. Mom kept them for ceremonial occasions in the buffet, and I found myself hoarding matches and flashlights, candles, piling them up in the corners. There was only night and day. Time had lost its meaning, and I had food and clothing. And then I had books to read. The Bible. And I read the Bible.
Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for thy love is better than wine.
There was a faint but unmistakable light burning that night a mile away on Knob Hill. I got into the car and drove to the light. I parked the car. I reached for my hammer. In the window, a shadow moved. As I approached the door, a flashlight caught me in its glare. I stopped, dead still. I waited for someone to say, "Put your hands up. Who are you?" There was a breath of perfume.
That's a nice car.
I can pick up a better one on any street corner.
Come on in.
Thanks.
How about some coffee?
Sounds good.
How come you didn't find me before this?
Well, I just saw the light tonight. I decided to investigate.
I saw your light lots of times.
Oh?
You live down on San Lupo Drive.
Well, why didn't you come in?
Woman's pride. Man's supposed to come after the woman.
Uh-huh. That was before. There are no rules now.
No, but they're habits. Won't you use black?
Yeah, black's fine.
I don't want you to think you're the first one I've met. There were five or six others. They saw the light and they came in. They had coffee and I sent them on.
What about me?
I don't know you.
Well, I'm clean, well-educated, healthy, young.
Those are the good things.
I dislike turnips, canned beans, stupid people.
What's your name?
You'll laugh.
I would laugh. What's your name?
Isherwood, my mother's maiden name. Everybody calls me Ish.
Well, mine's Emma. Emma and Ish. Nobody's going to write me love songs with that combination.
No. No, imagine they will.
I like you. Coffee will be ready in a minute.
Emma, will you come and live with me?
I don't know you.
What is there to know? That I like you, and you like me? That we're both alone. Emma?
What?
Emma? Good.
Ceremony. It ought to be some kind of ceremony.
Have you a Bible?
Bible? On the mantel. I've never used it. I just had it. Here?
Give me your hand. Now, we shall be together always. Emma was warm and understanding, good woman, a healthy woman. Soon there was a baby to be born. I had read some books, but I couldn't read enough. I stood by her during the night and tried to help. When the morning came, we had a son, the first born since the great disaster. Then there was the matter of time.
We won't need to know the exact hour.
No, that's true. The clocks have stopped, but what's the difference? We eat when we're hungry, and when we're tired, we go to bed.
But the months and the years. It's important to know when the year ends.
Well, that's what I've been doing out on the porch.
What is that thing out there?
Well, it's a transit. See, I set it towards the sun, and when the sun reaches the winter solstice, I know that to be the shortest day of the year. And that will be our new year.
Well, New Year's Day isn't the shortest day of the year.
No, December 21st is. And we'll make that our new year.
Anne's always been trying to get close to that date for the new year, but calendar makers always went off.
How long will it be?
A few days.
Then it'll be 1950 what?
No. That was the old calendar. This will be our year one.
The year one. We must call it something. I know. We'll call it the year of the baby.
The new life began around the simple problems of Emma, myself, and the baby. The day came when the sun reversed its path. I took my hammer and a chisel. Emma and I found a tall, smooth rock in what had once been a small public park. In the rock, I carved the figure one. The new beginning, I said to her. The rebirth of man. In the year two, the rats came. San Francisco was overrun with them. They had broken into most of the grocery stores, torn open the cartons, gorged themselves, and gave birth to more rats. They multiplied by the hundreds and then the thousands. Rats, the carriers of deadly bubonic plague.
Come quick, they're getting in.
Where?
Here. It's through the door.
Now get me that kitchen chair. Hurry now, hurry.
Here. They're going to the bedroom, toward the baby.
Now hold the chair against the opening. I'll nail it later. I rushed into the bedroom, taking my hammer with me. There were two of them, tremendous rats. I stationed myself at the crib. One came toward me, unafraid, for the fear of man had been bred out of them. And I flung the hammer at him. I missed. The rat leaped up into the crib. I threw a blanket over him and flung him to death on the floor. Then I picked up the hammer and threw it at the other one. Dead. But that was just two of them. Outside, I could hear hundreds squealing, their tiny feet scratching at the walls. How long would it be before they destroyed us? Man was gone now. This was the age of the rats. Now it was year three. Em, the baby, and I were struggling for existence amid the fast-decaying wealth of San Francisco.
Oh!
All right, now, be careful. Careful, Em.
Isn't it funny? It always makes me feel like I'm doing something wrong.
What?
Now I'm breaking into the biggest food store on Market Street.
Not wrong, Em. There's no private property anymore. This city, this grocery store, it's all ours now.
But Ish, look. Look at this place.
Yeah, the rats left their mark here, all right. There's the answer to their death. They ate all the food they could get at, and they ate each other.
Oh, it's so horrible.
Yeah, it's a familiar pattern, Em. Species grows, dominates the earth for a short time, then dies. Now, come on. We'll take a look at the bottles and the canned goods.
Ish, look, the labels are gone. They're eaten off.
Yeah, well, we'll just have to try to guess at the contents by the shape of the can.
Well, the bottles are easy. Here, look. Bottles of real lemon juice.
Fine. This should be corned beef.
Look at it all. Tons of it. We could live on just this forever.
No, Em. We can't be scavengers forever. That's why the rats died. Em, we've got to grow things. We've got to bring something new into the world. Well, come on. Let's get some of this stuff home. During that year, Em and I found whatever we needed for ourselves and the baby in the empty, silent stores of San Francisco. We lived on the spoiling supplies of a million people. One evening, just after dusk, I suddenly noticed a strange, wavering glow in the sky over the downtown area of the city. I called Em to the window. There was a smell of smoke in the air. Fire, Em!
Yes.
San Francisco's on fire!
Yes. Isn't there something we can do?
No. If there were, it must be 3 square miles of flame.
What started it, do you suppose?
We'll never know. Oily rags in the basement, some gasoline explosion. Could be any one of 1,000 causes.
Will it reach the house?
No, I don't think so. Wind's blowing it away from us. It'll burn itself out in a day or two.
Well, come away from the window.
Em. Em, do you smell gas?
I don't know.
It smells like it to me.
Open the door to the hall.
Yeah.
Hey, the hall is filled with it. Hey, we've got to get out of here. Gas line must have burst. One spark in this place will blow up like a bomb.
Baby, I'll get the baby.
All right. We'll be safe on the fire escape. Hurry, Em. Here, I'll take the baby.
Be careful.
Now just hang on to the rail. Now walk slowly. Come on. We started down the fire escape. In the distance, the flames were gutting the heart of the city. Parts of Chinatown were already gone. Kept going down the street level, and then we started running. Any second, a spark could blow the building to dust, and we ran, our breath tearing our throats. Back against the wall end, the shock wave. Em, is she all right?
Oh, my God.
It's all over, Em. We're going to be all right. We moved to another section of town that had been spared by the fire. The days passed, the days and the weeks. Em and I were growing tired of the canned foods and wanted some fresh vegetables and fruit. But we needed a car. One day, Em and I found a Jeep in a garage. In the storeroom, I found new tires to replace the rotted ones the Jeep had been standing on.
Will it work?
Well, after 2 years, hard to say. I'm no mechanic.
All the cars to choose from, and we pick something like this. I always wanted a convertible. Maybe a Cadillac or a Packard.
It's more useful and more durable. Besides, it's all we need. All right, Em. Let's try it. Step on the starter.
Mm-hmm.
No. All right, now try it. Oh, come on. Come on, start. Oh. Good. Come on. Good. Come on.
She did it.
One night, several months later, Em shook me awake.
Ish.
Huh?
Ish, wake up.
Hmm?
There's something outside moving around.
Huh?
Right by the window.
Give me the hammer.
Be careful, Ish.
I'll be all right.
I'll come with you.
I'll stay here. I'll be right back. Who's there? Girl. Come here. I won't hurt you. Come here. What are you doing?
Eileen. My name is Eileen.
Where are you from?
Eileen. Hungry.
Well, come on inside.
Eileen. Oh, I've been looking all over for you, Eileen. Where have you been? Okay, mister. You can put that hammer down. I ain't going to hurt you.
Oh, sure. Sure, well, come on inside. Em! Em, somebody's here!
Just Eileen and me. She's my adopted daughter. About a year ago, I found her on Main Street in Los Angeles. She was starving. Can't forage for herself, Eileen can't, so I got to take care of her. She can't think so good.
Well, how long you been here?
About 2 days, wandering around the city. Nice city, this San Francisco. Wished I'd have visited here when it had people. Reckon I really could have had myself a time.
I'll get you two something to eat.
Well, that's mighty nice. By the way, I sure am an impolite cuss. If my name's Ezra, I don't believe I caught yours.
Isherwood. This is M.
Well,
hello.
I'm happy to know you. Eileen, looks like we've met up with some real nice people.
As
Ezra and his new daughter Eileen stayed with us, made their home in the house next door. Now the year 3 has passed. We called it the year of Ezra. November, the year 4. A woman came a week ago. She had dark hair, dark eyes. She was alone. Ezra has taken her for his wife. June 9th, the year 5. Our second son was born this day. We named him Joey. April, the year 6. Two men and a woman have come. George says he's a carpenter. Harry worked in a bank. Well, he'll have to learn a trade. The woman is called Mabel.
Ish. Ish, you better come with me.
Well, what's the matter?
The water. It stopped running in the faucets.
Well, maybe it's just a broken pipe in your place.
No, I checked, and it ain't just my place. I've checked all the houses around, and there ain't any water running in any of them.
Maybe it's a water main under the street.
I don't think so. You know what I think?
What?
I think the water stopped way up in the mountains someplace. Ish, San Francisco's going dry.
Two weeks, not a drop of rain. Ezra, we can't go on boiling the water forever. If we're going to live, we've got to get out of here.
Yeah, but there's still all them canned goods.
That's what's wrong, Ezra. We've been living off the old instead of building something new. But we've got to forget that water ran out of faucets and vegetables come in cans. We've got to start growing things ourselves.
We will when the time comes, yes. I reckon.
You better come quick.
What is it, Em?
Eileen.
What's the matter with her?
She must have been drinking polluted water.
Typhoid.
Well, what does the book say, Ish? What are we going to do?
Isolate the others. Mabel can nurse Eileen.
What do we do for her? What's the treatment?
You can't shorten the disease, it says. All you can do is help make it less severe. Now, don't worry, Ezra. We'll do our best.
Eileen, she's so helpless. She don't understand.
Yeah, but you move in with us. This thing spreads, it can wipe out all of us.
Another case.
Who is it?
George.
Move him in with Eileen. Get another bed in there.
You won't have to.
What do you mean?
Eileen's dead.
This is the year 6, a year of disease and death. I went to the drugstores, walking the misty, dark streets of the city, armed with my medical text, my hammer. I raided the dusty shelves and the long, warm refrigerators of the pharmaceutical departments. The wonder drugs had long since rotted in their vials. Some sulfur was still potent, and I used it liberally. Yet case after case of typhoid broke out. Some lived, most died, including our firstborn. Our little community, upon which I had pinned the hopes of a new birth of mankind, had dwindled from 12 persons to 7. 5 adults, only 2 children.
You've got to get some sleep, Ish.
How many of us are left, Em? Count them for me.
Ezra, George, Mabel, my second son, Joey, and Ezra's boy. You and I.
Oh, Em. Em, what's the good of starting again? We're being exterminated from the earth, every small being of us, so things can become green again.
There are 7 of us, Ish. Once there was only me, and once there was only you. Alone and separated. There are still 7.
Oh, Em. Em, what would I do without you?
Go to sleep.
Well, you won't make the mistake a second time. Won't be any looking back. You'll forget the train that used to run. And the tall buildings and the soft food to the earth. Back to the earth, then. Back to the earth. left San Francisco, we few survivors, we packed only the essentials, the machines, the conveniences. We left to the sun and the wind. From this time on, we'd work in the soil. The decay of the old times was behind us now. We went south and east until we came to a watered land, green, with growing things. This would be our Eden. Here, without the memories of a dead people about us, we would begin mankind again. Come here, Joey.
Yes, Daddy.
Joey, here. Sit down here next to me. I want to ask you some questions.
Sure.
Now, first of all, what year is this?
Well, that's an easy question. The year 15.
Joey, did you do your reading today?
Yeah.
Joey, there's something I want to tell you. You know, there were once a lot of people like us on Earth. Millions. You know that, don't you?
Yeah. I read about them. They could fly.
That's right. Well, someday there'll be millions of people again. And they'll fly again. Years and years from now. But after I'm gone, there won't be anybody to show them the way. That's why I'm depending on you.
What am I supposed to do?
Learn, read, study. You're going to lead them someday, Joey, after I'm gone. Don't let them go back. You don't understand.
I think I do.
Oh, well, you will. Oh, look. I want to show you what I made this morning.
What is it?
It's called a bow. Guns won't be good much longer. The powder will get rotten. Guns will get rusty. You can hunt with this, kill animals for food. Yeah, look here, see? I carved it out of willow. Then I strung strips of calf hide from one end of the bow to the other. And now watch this. See here, this is the arrow.
That's fun. Let me try.
All right, here.
Like this?
That's right. Now, pull back. Hard. No. Hard. There. Now, let go.
Boy, that's swell. Can I take it outside and play with it?
Sure, but be careful with it.
Hey, Billy, look what I got. Hey, Billy!
It took thousands of years for man to pass from the spear to the bow and arrow. I've just done it in 5 minutes. This is the year 19. I have gray hair. It's odd to think of myself as an old man. Well, I'm not really 51. There are 19 numbers in a smooth piece of rock in the meadow that I chipped in with my hammer and chisel. My hammer. What would I do without my hammer? Everything is going along well. Quite a farmer now. Community is growing. There are 45 of us. Strangers that drifted in. Babies born. Maybe man is something you can't quite kill off. A stranger named Charlie came in today. I don't like him. He's gruff and hard. And his eyes... I don't like his eyes.
Sure, 3 men at a time.
Gee, Charlie, how'd you do it?
With my bare hands. Came at me all at once. I grabbed two of them and banged their heads together. They cracked like coconuts. Then the other one I knocked down and stepped on his face. Wasn't much left of him after I got through.
Gee.
It's time for bed, Joey.
Oh, can't he tell one more, Dad?
Maybe some other night.
Okay. Good night, Dad. Good night, Charlie.
Good night, Joey.
Will you come tomorrow night?
Maybe. Great kid you got there.
What did you do in the old times, Charlie?
Oh, a lot of things. For a while, I was a stickman in Las Vegas. Used to be a fighter, too. A lot of things. You name it.
You intend to stay?
Sure I intend to stay. Why not? No other place to go. This is the only good-sized group of human beings I've seen. And believe me, I've been around. Sure, I'll stay.
Everybody works. It's the only way we can live.
Listen, you. If I want to stay, I'll stay, and I'll stay on my own terms. I don't ask anything from anybody. I live my own way. Better understand that right now.
And you better understand something before we go any further, Charlie. I've been elected to leadership in this town, and we aren't a bunch of independent individuals doing what we please. We're a community, working together.
Either you accept that, or get out.
We ain't gonna get along, Mr. Isherwood Williams. And I'm staying. Good night.
What is it?
I don't know.
Don't go out there, Ish.
Ish, he's roaring drunk.
Where is he?
Right outside.
Yeah. What's the matter? Are you afraid? Come on out.
Ish. Ish, don't go.
Well, well, well. The great Isherwood. Howdy, Isherwood.
Down that gun, you crazy fool.
Let go. Down. Let go of me, you.
Isher, are you all right?
Never mind me. Get that gun away from him. Get George.
Yeah. Where's George? Bring George. Let's see George take this gun away from me. Hey, George, come on and try to take this thing away from me.
Hey, what's going on here? Charlie, give me that gun.
Nobody's taking my gun away. It's mine.
Charlie.
Well, it's mine is mine. Stay away.
Give me that gun.
Stay away, George. Stay away. I told him to stay away. George. George!
He's dead. How are you? You've done enough damage with that thing. Hand it over.
There's only one answer. Death.
Death. You mean kill him? Murder him?
No, it's not murder, Em. You, Mabel, Nezra, and I, we're the government now. We've been elected. Council of Four. There isn't any government but us. It's not a matter of punishment. It's protecting the community from a menace, and that's what Charlie is.
But he was drunk.
All the more reason he might do it again.
Afraid so, Em. We can't take the chance.
We're like a jury.
Let's vote. We've got all the facts.
The vote's been called. Any questions?
Is it right? Is it right to take a human life?
To save many lives, yes, Em. It's got to be right. We'll take a voice vote. You first, Mabel. What do you say?
Death.
Ezra?
Death.
Em? Well, how do you vote, Em?
Death.
It's unanimous. We'll carry out the sentence tomorrow morning. The Council of Four had made its decision. This was not killing in passion or rage or hatred. This was the deliberate and sane elimination of an enemy. Early in the morning, we tied Charlie to an oak tree. Ezra took Charlie's revolver. Charlie stared at him with childish disbelief. He gasped, slumped into his ropes, his mouth red with blood, his eyes swollen in death. The power of the new state was born.
Carl, New Year. Here, carry my hammer for me.
No.
It won't hurt you. My hammer, here.
No, I don't want to.
Why not?
It's magic.
Magic? My hammer?
Aunt Phyllis says your hammer's magic. She says you're magic.
Carl, It's just a plain, ordinary hammer. No, no. Carl, don't be afraid.
No, it's magic. You're magic.
Dad?
Hello, Joey.
Carl, go and play.
Sure, Dad. Goodbye, Grandfather.
Joey, what's the matter with them? They say I'm magic. My hammer is magic.
You're a legend, Dad. You're the only one left out of them all. Ezra, George, Mabel, Mother M. All gone now. Only you. The hammer's a symbol. Symbol of leadership.
Yes. Yes, that's the way things happen.
You're the only one that's lived through from the old times.
The only one. The only one. Joey.
Yes, Dad?
I'm old. Very old. And I can't see very well. Did I make the numbers clearly?
Yes, Dad. 48. The year 48.
It's all begun again. Life. Generations and generations. O.M. If you could have lived to see your faith come true. And once there were only the two of us, alone and separated. I want to see the old once more before I die. Just once more. The bridge. The Golden Gate Bridge.
We're here, Dad.
How does it look, Joey? Tell me. How does the Golden Gate Bridge look?
It's old and rusty. But it's wonderful. It's beautiful.
Yeah. Is there a car? Small car on the bridge?
Yes, Dad. It's still there.
Can you still see buildings across the water?
Only a few, Dad. It's mostly overgrown. But the hills behind the city are beautiful today.
Good. Joey, here. Here's the hammer.
Yes, Dad.
You're the new leader now. The hammer has always been the symbol. Pass it on to the best of them. And, Joey, don't let them make a god of you. Let knowledge be the watchword. Oh, when you understand, Joey.
I understand, Dad.
Know the earth, Joey. Know the earth.
Dad! Men go and come. But the earth abides.
Escape is produced and directed by Norman MacDonald. You have just heard Earth Abides by George Stewart, especially adapted for Escape by David Ellis. John Daner was starred as Ish with Peggy Weber as M. Featured in the cast were Michael Ann Barrett, Parley Bear, Jeffrey Silver, Paul Fries, Lou Krugman, and Larry Dobkin. The special music for Escape was arranged and conducted by Ivan Dittmars.
That's Earth Abides. And this is the show for tonight. I'm going to go home. Actually, I am home. I do this from my house. You probably didn't need to know that. Anyway, this is Billy May playing in the background. This song is Ira Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue. Good night.